Welcome to the France 24 debate. Ukraine is facing another huge challenge in its fight to save its borders, its land and its people. The military battle continues, as it has since 2014, as it was since it was stepped up in 2022. This Thursday, Ukrainians still clearing up after the massive drone and missile attack on Ternopil. Two apartment blocks there were hit, 26 civilians confirmed dead, over 20 still unaccounted for. Let's show you a map that shows you the range of Russia's strikes on Ukraine over the past 2 days. And of course, the situation is evolving. The only certainty is that there will be more Russian attacks on Ukraine in the hours to come. The new challenge then is the emergence of a US-Russia plan to end the war. That might seem like good news, but when you look at it, of course, the devil's in the detail. It's left observers perplexed, the Ukrainians open-mouthed in shock. This plan seems to be trying to press-gang Ukraine to give up land, arms, its armies, to placate Putin's Russia. There would also be cultural changes in force, such as the suppression of the Ukrainian language in favour of Russian. Trump's go-to man on all key world issues, it seems, Steve Witkoff, there he is. This is archive of him in Moscow. And Kirill Dmitriev, a Putin advisor who isn't subject to a travel ban, unlike his boss, met in Miami late last month to hatch this plan, and it reads like a text that could have been composed by Vladimir Putin himself. In this debate, we ask a very simple question. What on earth were they thinking when they put this plan together? We'll meet our guests after this report from Selina Sykes.
Their meeting in Alaska in August was billed as a big step towards peace in Ukraine.
Thank you very much, Vladimir.
Next time in Moscow.
Ultimately, the summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, without Volodymyr Zelensky, failed to yield any tangible progress towards peace. But is that about to change? Reports of a peace plan drafted by Washington and Moscow to end the war in Ukraine have emerged. The 28-point plan, understood to be inspired by Trump's Israel-Gaza deal, covers four main topics: peace in Ukraine, security guarantees, security in Europe, and future U.S. relations with Russia and Ukraine. Its architects, U.S. Special Envoy for Peace Mission Steve Witkoff and Kremlin advisor Kirill Dmitriev. The draft plan, first reported by U.S. news website Axios, would require Ukraine to cede territory in the eastern Donbas region, currently under its control, in return for a U.S. security guarantee for Kyiv and Europe against future Russian aggression. It would also ask Ukraine to cut the size of its armed forces by half and limit U.S. military assistance that has been vital to its defense since Moscow's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Conditions which Zelensky has called non-starters in the past. The Trump administration has repeatedly suggested that it's closing in on a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. But proposals have failed in the past because they would have granted Moscow most of its demands while requiring Kyiv to make painful concessions. Zelensky, who held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Wednesday, is set to meet with a U.S. delegation currently in Ukraine on Thursday. No face-to-face talks have taken place between Kyiv and Moscow since the meeting in Istanbul in July.
Selina Sykes bringing us up to date. Let's bring in our guests to debate this plan, the US-Russia plan to bring peace to Ukraine, but at what cost? Joining us here in the studio, we have Vera Grantseva, who's a Russian political scientist and lecturer at Sciences Po in Paris. Vera, thank you for joining us here in the studio. Great. Hello. To see you. On the other side of the studio, but not necessarily against, but we'll see. Michael Benamou is from the OPY think tank, where he is executive director. Michael, pleasure to have you here again. Always nice to see you. Two guests joining us from afar. First, Hannah Schelest, who's in Odessa. Good evening, Hannah. Director of Security Programs at Ukrainian PRISM. Hannah, thanks for being with us. And joining us from Washington, D.C., at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, all-seeing, all-knowing Melinda Haring. Melinda, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Great to see you. I'm going to start with you. If you had Steve Witkoff in front of you right now, what would you say to him?
I don't think I can say what I would tell Steve Witkoff on the air, Mark. You're tempting me. I'm going to get in trouble right away. You'll never invite me on your show again. I think I would say to him, what on earth are you thinking? So this deal, as it's reported, I haven't seen it, and I don't think you have either. But based on the people who've talked on the record, say the following. It's asking Ukraine to give up territory that it currently holds. Why on earth would Ukraine do that in exchange for all kinds of massive limitations, in exchange for security guarantees that are not defined, and there's no role for NATO. So this is a ridiculous deal. This is not serious, and it's not going anywhere.
Linda, thank you. Hannah Celeste in Odessa, give us your sense of what this means. You're there. What are people saying? What are people thinking? Give us the news from Odessa.
It's not only from Odessa, but from the whole Ukraine. It is frustration. That's probably the main word that can characterize the news over here. Because first of all, there is definitely not a peace plan. Let's stop calling these proposals that we heard in the media a peace plan. It is everything but not a peace plan. There is nothing about peace over there. The second, it is really sounds strange. You have a Russian-American peace plan for Ukraine. So the aggressor is drafting a peace plan together with that country that should be a security guarantor. Honestly, for 30 years studying conflicts around the globe, I never heard such a nonsense, because that really sounds like a judge and the rapist is deciding the future of the victim.
Indeed, it's strange thing to consider that you could talk about, say, for instance, what concerns my future, and it's just, say, you and Melinda making that decision with no discussion with me, and that would make no sense on a personal level. Then you transpose that to the Ukrainian situation, it's even worse when you consider what's at stake. Hannah, thank you now for the moment. Let's bring in Vera Grantseva here in the studio. Vera, this plan, it seems as though it's almost been composed by Vladimir Putin.
Yes, sure. I think it's quite obvious that this plan reflects for maybe 99% Russian demands and Russian vision of how Ukraine should capitulate. It's not about the peace. It's just about Russia to be able to take from Ukraine the territories, which it doesn't manage to take in a military way. We've seen from 2022 that Russian army wasn't able to really conquer the territories of Ukraine, and even to conquer Donbass, which was the main target of Putin ever since he became obsessed with Ukraine. So it's just a diplomatic way how to get what Putin army doesn't manage to get in a military way. So unfortunately, in White House right now, we have some allies of Putin who are helping him to get this plan done and to capitulate Ukraine.
And allies of Putin. Of course, Trump says that he's a man of peace, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's also a card which Putin has been trying to play since the return of Trump to the White House. So he's trying to sell him the idea that this will bring peace to Ukraine. And by the way, it's very interesting to see what we see from the information from media, what Russia promises in return for concessions from Ukraine. So Russia can, as Kremlin says, guarantee in its constitution that it will never attack Ukraine or Europe. But I think whoever knows Putin and his regime and how many lies already were published by this regime, we'll know that Russian Constitution doesn't worth anything. It had been changed already, by the way, very quickly to continue Putin's regime. So we see that it's very easy to manipulate such unprofessional politicians as Witkov became. He has never been a politician. Actually, he was
real estate,
real estate manager. So for Putin, it's an easy actually target which he can manipulate quite fine and with pleasure, I think. So unfortunately, such kind of people are now in the White House and they are impacting American president.
Indeed, Witkoff's role does seem surreal when you consider what his background is, but he's clearly not a stupid person by any stretch of the imagination, but one wonders whether he understands the full complexity of the decisions that are being taken. Michael, your sense?
I feel that not much has happened over the last 3 years, frankly, whether tactically or diplomatically. This plan that we're debating, it's almost the same plan as in Istanbul in 2022. Tactically, it's also almost the same situation. Putin was able to take 1% of new territory since October 2022. 1% for 1 million killed or wounded. So this is a very depressing situation for everyone, for the Russians, for Ukrainians. And we are stuck because Putin and his regime, as you said, they continue to believe that time is for them, is in favor of their side, which is probably not the case, but this is what they believe tactically and strategically. So we are still debating. I think we should be debating this, by the way, but I mean, it's still the same parameters for the last 3 years, because we have people in Moscow who do not see the reality. And at the same time, we have an America which is more and more difficult to trust, more and more difficult to follow, and a Europe which is not ready to replace fully America in Ukraine and for its own security.
We're hearing that from the Russian chief of staff, Gerasimov, Russia's taking control of the city of Kupiansk in Ukraine. We'll try to get more clarification on that. That's just from one source at this present moment in time, but we hear that that is what is happening. Let's get the words now of Kaja Kallas, who is the EU's spokesperson on foreign policy. She was speaking a little earlier about, well, in the wake of this announcement of this new plan, but also talking about Russia's shadow fleet.
What we as Europeans have always supported is a long-lasting and just peace, and we welcome any efforts to achieve that. Of course, for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. So this is very clear. Also, we have to understand that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim, so we haven't heard of any concessions on the Russian side.
We await to find out what more is being said. Let's go back to Melinda Haring in Washington, D.C. from the Atlantic Council, the Eurasia Center there. Melinda, I'll put you on the spot again by asking you what you'd say to someone in particular. And I understand the diplomacy of your answer, but it's very clear how you feel about the situation. And that, I think, feeling is shared by all who will look upon this in a fair and balanced manner. Where is this deal coming from then, from the American sense? Can you give us an idea, a clue as to what that might be?
Sure, Mark. That's a great question. So I think the context is really interesting. Why is this emerging now? Because this deal caught the Europeans off guard and it caught the Ukrainians off guard. So what we know is this deal came from Witkoff and with his counterpart in Moscow. And Witkoff has been working on it quietly. He says he's talked to the Russians. He says he's talked to the Ukrainians. I'd love to hear more about which Ukrainians he spoke to as he was putting this deal together. But there's some context that matters here, that it sort of determines whether this moves forward or not. One piece of context is that General Keith Kellogg, who was the U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine, President Trump's envoy, is going to be stepping down in January. And to my mind, General Kellogg is the only sensible one in the White House who understands the stakes, who is sympathetic to the Ukrainian position. Witkoff definitely is not. So this is bad news. Witkoff is powerful. He has the president's ear. And I think we're going to hear more of these kinds of proposals. The second factor that we need to take into account is that President Zelensky is in political trouble. So there's a giant corruption scandal that broke in Ukraine over the last week. And it shows just how fragile Zelensky's political coalition is. People very close to the president were involved in terrible corruption deals in the middle of the war, and the Ukrainian public is furious. So I think Moscow is calculating that now is the time to push again for a peace deal, as Zelensky is perceived as being weaker.
Linda, thank you very much indeed. Back to Hannah Schlest in Odessa. Hannah, the fall of Kupiansk has been announced here via the wires service. Now, we're waiting to get another source on that one. And 80% of Vovshansk fallen too. This could just be Russia saying, as it often says, that it's done more than it actually has on the battlefield. So I'll just put that into the mix for you to think about a little bit there. What I'm wondering is, if Vladimir Zelensky, as he has just said, apparently, is going to work with the US on points of this peace plan, how will that conversation go, do you think? What will Zelensky be saying to them?
Yeah, first, very briefly about Kupiansk. The Russians announced already at least 10 times that they occupied it, and they hear it each second month. So before having the really reliable information, I would not trust the Russian general staff. And sometimes just bringing one, two soldiers, they are already saying that they are controlling one or another village. So that is also definitely not the control from the military point of view. But if we return back to your question about the peace plan and the readiness of the Ukrainian president, here we need to understand that considering the emotions and emotional approach to any type of the negotiations that we see in Washington, Ukrainian president would never say that he's not ready for negotiations. First of all, because in general, Ukraine is ready for negotiations. We've been ready since the day one. The question is that when President Zelensky had been traveling to Istanbul, for example, Russian president never came there. So here, in general, are we ready to discuss any peace plan? Yes, we are ready. The second, we know that when Russia is demanding these maximalist conditions, what they also want? They want to portray that there are Ukrainians who are bad guys in this story, who don't want any type of the peace negotiations. We are militarized Nazi, wherever you can continue this line of the Russian propaganda. So it is Ukrainians who are rejecting any proposals of the peace. That's why this maximalist demands, because they know that they would be unacceptable. Doesn't matter Zelensky strong or weak domestically, because his political opponents have absolutely the same ideas about territorial integrity of Ukraine or about the future of the Ukrainian armed forces. So here, Ukrainian president diplomatically definitely would say that he is ready for the conversation with Mr. Trump, that he is ready to discuss any peace proposals. Another question, is he ready to accept any of them?
Anna, thank you. This new Witkoff Dmitriev plan then consulting neither Ukrainians nor Europeans. One might be forgiven for thinking the question may well concern the 27 EU states and the United Kingdom, given the war is on our doorstep, given Europe's engagement to help Ukraine to its ambition of a peaceful and democratic future. Charlie James has this on Euro reaction to this plan.
Top European ministers angry and mystified over talk of a secret peace plan for Ukraine. Convening in Brussels, one after another, they demanded Russia and the United States stop cutting them out.
There can be no peace without Ukraine, and Europe has to be at the table.
Questions about whether shift of land and territory should be a part of a peace must not be negotiated, you know, without the Ukrainians.
And it's, of course, Europe's security that's at stake, so we expect to be consulted.
The reported outline of the U.S.-Russia negotiated peace plan includes many of Russia's key demands, significant territorial concessions by Ukraine, cutting Ukrainian troop levels in half, and forbidding any NATO forces in the country. All factors Russia claims are essential to its future security.
Russia continues to remain open to a settlement, but the settlement must lead to the elimination of the root causes of this conflict. That's what we talk about all the time.
European support for Ukraine is not unanimous. On Thursday, Hungary, which has a cozy relationship with Russia, said EU efforts are fruitless.
The war has been going on for almost 4 years now, and Russia has been occupying more and more Ukrainian territories. Plus, the sanctions have not pushed the Russian economy on its knees. So I think saying that the time is on the side of Ukraine is an illusion.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and security are a matter of the country's survival. But with Russia's ceaseless bombings and a corruption scandal knocking Ukraine on its heels, Russia may hope it can exploit the weakness and force Ukraine and Europe to accept.
Charlie James there. The question is then, what can Europe do against this situation? Clearly, as our guests have already pointed out, Europe taken by surprise by what has happened. Of course, it's only a matter of days ago that Emmanuel Macron was announcing 100 Rafale jets going to Ukraine over the next 10 years, a massive deal to help Ukraine build its military. There's a symbol of European commitment to help Ukraine. But when you have Dmitry Peskov there, and I'll bring this you on in on this one, Vera, Peskov saying that you need to eliminate the root causes of this conflict. There is only one root cause, isn't there, of this conflict?
Yeah, that's true. Bon, Peskov, he is telling the same story, which, by the way, Putin started to tell about this of this war in order to explain it also to its own domestic audience, audiences, but also to the broader audiences worldwide. So in order to explain why they are shelling cities and killing civilians massively, they had to invent a story. So this story with the very vague, by the way, very blurred, very unprecise what are initial roots of the conflict, etc. So it's something, for me, it's kind of a special tool of propaganda in order to kind of get people lost in the very complex story, which they try to render complex, although it's very, very easy. Ukraine is just a sovereign state which wants to have its own independent decision and politics whether to join different international alliances or not. not. So they try to kind of blur the picture in order to justify themselves, because the whole world watches what they're doing. We remember that the UN General Assembly also condemned Russian invasion. So it's a propaganda method, which, by the way, is not very functioning, even for Russian society. If you will talk today to Russians or see sociological polls, you will see that Russians, they cannot explain the real reasons of this war, because even for Russians, these explications were too complicated, too blurred. So it's a matter of propaganda, which just help them to justify and to make people get lost in these various complex explanations. But I think the world reaction demonstrates that it's not very efficient, and finally, nobody believes in such stories told by the Kremlin.
And you point out that even Russian people watching this on their own TV channels, listening to it on their radio stations within Russia's borders, aren't convinced, because the explanation is just too unfeasible, too vague, too difficult. Vera, thank you. Michael, can I bring you in? Hungary's minister there in Brussels talking about it's been a fruitless war, basically saying it's upon continuing, this can't go any further, this is probably the way ahead. That's not shared by the rest of Europe, but nonetheless, it is an opinion. And I'm wondering, where can Europe go on this one? Because clearly, stepping into that breach that has been vacated by the Americans in terms of supporting Ukraine is no easy matter.
I think what is important to say to begin with, and I may be a bit too frank here, but I believe that what America says now in 2025, it just matters less and less, you know. Sometimes when I mean, I love America personally, by the way, but it feels like the UK of the 1930s or 40s, you know, in Palestine, Israel, or India, when what the British were saying mattered less and less, actually, you know, on the ground. Look at what is going on. America now is not financing, is not giving weapons directly to Ukraine. The Europeans are actually buying weapons to America for Ukraine. Look at America's aircraft carrier. It is not in the Mediterranean. It is not in the Med anymore. It is in the Caribbean. Look at also this statement by the U.S. ambassador to NATO that said that Germany one day will be the head of NATO. Look at the reduced presence of American forces in Romania. We have so many signals showing that actually the Americans are not putting the money and the troops sufficiently to have actually such diplomatic influence in Ukraine and in Europe anymore. And so I think the Europeans, they see that, they know it. They also know that they don't have enough military capacities right now. They hope to have these military capacities in 5 years, 2030, let's say, to be able to project more power against Russia, for sure, but also in the Mediterranean. In the military, you know, procurement takes time, you know, because these military systems are very heavy, they're very expensive, they are pluriannual, and so it takes a lot of time. But I think Europeans will get there. But yes, we have a gap right now between now and, let's say, 2030, definitely, which is a bit frightening, because the Russians can do a lot of things during that security gap.
Melinda, can I bring you back in on that issue about basically Europe trying to step into the gap there? Because clearly, as Michael's pointing out, it's going to take time to get the wheels in motion to make the arms that need to be made. Donald Trump, in the meantime, happy to sell, basically, to see this as a transaction. And is that possibly what's behind this whole plan that Witkoff has concocted? The idea that somewhere behind that, the US, via various companies, will be making a lot of money out of it?
No, Mark, I think it's more simple than what you're saying. I think this is about male ego. Donald Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize, and he knows that his quote-unquote victories or peace agreements that he's brokered haven't gotten him this prize that he covets. So I think that's basically what this is about. Could there be business deals involved? Yes. Now, as to what Michael says, there's a lot of truth in what he says, but I would just say to him, brother, don't write America off yet. Ukraine cannot prosecute the war without our intelligence sharing, without U.S. targeting, and without the weapons packages that the Biden administration put in place. Is it possible that Donald Trump will have a change of heart? I think it is. I think the scales are falling off his eyes now, And I think that he understands the stakes of what's happening in Ukraine. He certainly knows more. His relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky is warmer. It is not out of the question. If you look at public opinion polling in America, more and more Republicans believe that we, the United States, should be giving assistance to Ukraine, armed assistance to Ukraine. And once they find out about the kidnapping of Ukrainian children, Russia has kidnapped at least 20,000 Ukrainian children. It's probably more like 700,000. Support for Ukraine goes up 20 points among MAGA voters. So this is not an impossible issue. Donald Trump is uncertain. He's unpredictable. But this is actually one of the things that makes him an interesting president. So he's volatile and he scares the pants off of a lot of heads of state. And he scares Putin a little bit. This is a good thing.
You mentioned the issue of the children being kidnapped. Of course, because of that, Vladimir Putin is facing a war crimes arrest warrant. Let's take a look now at a documentary made by the Bring Back Kids Foundation, the foundation started by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Мене звати Саша, мені 12 років. І я з березня місяця минулого року шукаю свою маму. Її звати Козлова Сніжана Михайлівна. Нас розлучили в фільтраційному таборі в селі Безіменно. Росіяни говорили, що я мамі не потрібен, що віддадуть в прийомну сім'ю в Росії. Уявіть, вони навіть не дали мені попрощатися з мамою.
Я живу в Херсонській області, село Киселівки. Ми пішли з дядьком десь обід погуляти. І якраз їдуть окупанти. І вони зупиняються і перевіряють телефони. Побачили ті окупанти, що ми переписувалися з українськими військовими, забрали нас на заправку, побили нас там по почкам, по лиці. Потім кинули там нас в яму, там де свинячі чи якісь там кишки були. Два часи ми там побули, угрожали, що гранату кинете. Кинемо в яму зараз, застрелимо у вас. Накинули мішок, затяжками зав'язали, натягли руки і повезли, закинули в бобік автомобіль, повезли нас в Херсон. Я просив, щоб я зв'язався з батьками, вони мені не давали.
Let's bring in Hannah Shalesta in Odessa there. Hannah, not enough is said about these children who've been taken. Some have come back, but there are many more that are still out there. And clearly this is an issue. And let's hope people in the United States, maybe even Steve Witkoff and the like, are watching this program and hear your reply here. It's vitally important to get those children back.
Yes, that's exactly. And let's be honest, Ukraine has been talking about these since the day one. It's been even several United Nations special meetings about these. There were resolutions about these. There are plenty of the coalitions, international organizations joining to help. Countries like Qatar, for example, helping to return back. But one of the biggest problems is also to find these kids, because it's not only these type of the stories that you just demonstrated, but also Russians are just changing their certificate of birth, their names. And when we had one of the projects, for example, that tried to search for these kids, could find some of them at the websites for adoption of the kids under the different names. So you understand that it is the whole bubble of the crimes. And the biggest problem that the Russian kids ombudsman, so exactly the person who should be in charge to protect the rights of the kids, adopted one of such kidnapped kids and proudly saying on Russian TV that she's trying to re-educate these kids who are singing Ukrainian anthem, and that means that they are behaving bad. So in this case, Ukraine been calling, but everybody being like more busy with the weapons, security guarantees or Russian sanctions, thinking that is it really important? And that is probably the dichotomy of this war. Because sometimes of any of the conflicts, we are forgetting that the real face of the enemy is in such stories, not only in the number of the drones that are attacking the Ukrainian territory, not only about the destruction of the critical infrastructure. And for me, that is the best demonstration that this war is not about security guarantees for the Russian Federation. It's not about their fear of NATO. Because if you're afraid of NATO, you're talking about Ukrainian armed forces, maybe, about Ukrainian politics. You're not kidnapping the kids. You're not ruining the lives of the hundreds of thousands of people at the occupied territories. You're not re-educating Ukrainian kids to be Russians. You're not sending them to the military camps. And now we have a lot of the approved stories, thanks also to the Russian human rights defenders who found it out, that many of these Ukrainian kids are sent to the special vacation camps, as they call it, but de facto it is the military camp where, since the age of six, they learned how to use weapons and how to hate Ukraine.
It's heartbreaking to hear what you're saying, Hannah. Heartbreaking testimony from the youngsters, of course, in that documentary from Bring Kids Back, the foundation begun by President Zelensky to try to get as many kids back as possible. Let's come back to the studio with Michael and Vera. This story, it really is, as Melinda said, Vera, it's one of these things that when people see this and they see it that it's children, it really connects with them. And this really needs to be given far more prominence, doesn't it? And, of course, in this deal, there is no mention of the kids, as far as we know.
Sure. And in general, if we think how the whole negotiations around Ukraine since Trump returned back to the White House were framed, it's very interesting to see how they kind of forget the fact that we are not talking about territories. It's not about the borders. It's about people living there. So when they tell to Ukrainians, I mean, to cede territories, it's a wrong framing, and it's done on purpose, because it's not about ceding territories. It's about ceding people living there. And it's I think, very important that Kremlin manages to impose.
Russia argues that the people that they've got in the Donbass, the areas they argue that they've liberated them.
Yeah, but we know now, we have a lot of evidences how Russia treated people there and how many people left also this region because of Russian army. And these stories also can confirm that it's not about people. It's about imperial ambitions of Putin for his regime to continue his power in Russia, because he doesn't have any more sense for Russians. It started not yesterday, it started already in 2012 when he got back to power. So it's very important also to highlight always and to frame it in the right sense, and to call everybody to see the realities, that it's not about territories, it's about real people who will suffer, who will be tortured by Russian army, which was the case already. So it's very important also to kind of resist to this wrong framing, which is favorable to Putin ambitions.
The things that we saw in Bucha, in Irpin at the start of the conflict, of course, the lifting, the kidnapping of these children, Michael, we're in a situation where the case against Russia stacks higher and higher and higher, but it seems that the US, when it goes into negotiations, gets kind of blinded by something. What does it get blinded by? Any thoughts?
I would not be able to say. I mean, I think that the Americans care less and less about what is going on abroad. They have many issues internally. They have an economy which is not doing that well. They have drugs also issues. So, I mean, we also have issues in Europe. And don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Europe is not doing...
I don't think anybody thought you meant
that. ...not doing better. But I think this is a world which is now in contraction, which is stagnating into a large extent.
That's Trumpism, isn't it? That's what Trump's
and
about.
And he's embodying that, I think. But, you know, I mean... President Obama said the same when he said that we should do nation building at home. I saw that with my own eyes. I mean, I saw a speech of Barack Obama in 2012 saying that to American soldiers on an Afghanistan base. And so I think this is a trend. I would also like to say to Melinda that she's right, that these are American weapons going to Ukraine. But now these weapons are being purchased by Europeans, you know. And in the army, which is the world where I come from, you are only as strong as what you pay for, and only as strong as the number of troops that you put in something. And right now, America is putting less and less of its energy, funds, and troops for this. And so, and Europeans are putting, you know, more and more of their treasure and maybe soon their troops, because
it's time in trying to close that gap.
We have conversation. Yeah, we have conversation in Paris now about sending perhaps a European military intervention force in Ukraine in the case of a ceasefire. But what happens next year if there is no ceasefire? The question will arise for Europeans to send a force anyway, perhaps to protect the west of Ukraine from Russian ballistic missiles, for example. So right now in Paris and beyond Paris, You have a lot of battlefield conversations about what the Europeans could do next year in support of Ukraine, but this time within Ukraine. And that's the difference between, I think, 2025 and previous years.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much indeed. Melinda, can I bring you back in on this issue? And clearly, there are battles ongoing to get territory, to take cities. We could talk about Pokrovsk, for instance, which is the scene of a particularly intense battle right now. But what you've identified with the remark about the children is a different type of battle. And do you think Ukraine in some way basically hasn't made enough of that? I don't mean this to sound cruel, because everyone feels it really intensely, but I'm thinking in terms of the mediatization of it. Clearly, this is something that perhaps, as you said, could be tugging at the heartstrings of lots of very influential people in the US.
Thanks for that question, Mark. It already is. So Melania Trump, the First Lady, knows about the issue of Russia's abduction of children, and she talks about it, and she reminds her husband about it. So yes, President Trump is unpredictable. I don't know where he's going to end up on any issue when it comes to foreign policy, but I know that Melania follows the war in Ukraine, and she talks to him about it privately. And when he goes and has these love fest conversations with Putin, he comes home and talks to her, and she says, "Not so fast, Donald. Vladimir just hit another hospital. He just hit more children." So I think this is a moral issue that touches the First Lady. We know that she cares about children. We know that Trump doesn't like war. So I see that as hopeful. But I just got back from the great state of Louisiana with a returned child from her son. His name is Danilo, and he's 16 years old. And I took him to Mike Johnson, the House Speaker's Baptist Church, for two services on Sunday. And this is Republican MAGA territory. And you wouldn't have known it. Hundreds of people came to the front of the church, and they wanted to pray with Danilo. They wanted to hug him. And they gave $6,000 on the spot to help an extraordinary Ukrainian organization called Save Ukraine. Save Ukraine is based in Kyiv, Ukraine, and it saved more than 1,000 children. It's run by a wonderful man named Mykola Kuleba. And I highly recommend this organization to anyone who wants to make a difference on this issue. But yes, this is the wedge issue to speak to people's hearts in America. We care deeply about Ukraine's children, and it's an issue that cuts across both liberal and conservatives.
Melinda, the telling of that story, you could hear the emotion in your voice. And I know you're a very straight down the middle kind of person. So clearly this touched you and unmistakably it's touching other Americans as well who are hearing about it. So thank you for telling us so honestly and openly about that. Hannah Celeste in Odessa, we're getting towards the end of the program now. And I'm wondering what you're feeling at this point, because we've been discussing, Hannah, why this has happened. Why we're in this position. We've been discussing how this deal came to be made. I mean, clearly the situation from your perspective, watching this in Odessa, wondering what happens next. What would your words be if you could possibly get the likes of Witkoff, Dmitriev together? What would your words be to the likes of Dmitry Peskov?
Dmitry Peskov is nothing to talk about, because this guy is just working to pay off the money he's receiving from the Russian regime, and his wife is perfectly enjoying her life in Paris. So that's definitely not the people to speak with. But Mr. Witkoff and others, I think that probably I would speak about how much they underestimate Ukraine. As you see by my picture, there is no electricity. And just now it is already the ninth hour without electricity. And today in the city of Odessa, I had it only for 3 hours. It doesn't stop me of being with you on the show. It doesn't stop me of doing my job and running the projects and doing just the normal life. So that says a lot about Ukraine. We understand what does mean the difficulties. We understand and we feel the sorrow of people around us. But at the same time, we are not stopping for the daily life, for surviving, for really being a nation that we deserve to be. And in this case, we really would like others not to feel pity about us, but to think how to help us to be on the right side. Because, for example, Chernobyl, the case that happened yesterday and shocked everybody with 26 people killed and 22 still in search, there were 100 spare parts in that missile made in the United States. And that says for me much more than any type of the peace proposal from the Mr. Witkoff. Because if you would like to have peace, make the aggressor not being able to continue this war. Otherwise, you can stop it for 2-3 days, but it would return again. And here, we don't want the return to this war again. We saw it around the globe. We don't want to be in the same club.
We need to leave it there, but we could go on for a lot longer because there's so much to discuss, so many things to work through. Hannah Schelest in Odessa, thank you very much for joining us. Hannah Schelest is Director of Security Programs at Ukrainian PRISM. Thanks for all your contributions. Thanks to Melinda Haring, joining us from Washington, D.C., as always, Eurasia Centre at the Atlantic Council. Thanks to you again, Melinda. Thanks to our guests here in the studio, Vera Grantseva, a Russian political scientist and lecturer at Sciences Po here in Paris, and, of course, Michael Ben-Hamoun from OPY Think Tank, the executive director of that. Thanks most of all to you for watching. Do stay with us here on France 24. More to come.